I have to be careful now. I'm wired for sound. Well, we have a rather intriguing subject this morning. The problem of memory. And I think too many of us take the whole field of mental continuities for granted, whereas in reality they are quite mysterious in their own right. Memory is something that we all need and we all abuse. Memory is something that helps us to build a philosophy of life, and it also can help us to tear one down very quickly. It can strengthen religion or destroy it. It can lead to happiness or misery. And in many cases, it contributes to life and hastens death. So altogether, we have to give this whole field a little special consideration, especially if we hope to unfold and develop the internal potentials of our own natures. To begin with, then, we have to try to understand that memory is a subject in great need of discipline. We must discipline the things we remember, and we must remember the things that we discipline. Now, memory discipline is something that is disappearing rapidly from our way of life. Today, everyone is pushing thoughts and responsibilities to one side. We are trying to avoid the monotonies and the routines and the skills which strengthen our memory power. Probably the most important thing that we gain from schooling is to strengthen and discipline memory. Most of what we may learn can perhaps be forgotten with benefit to all concerned. But the power to learn, the ability to maintain a continuity of recollections, the power to be able to answer the questions that are asked or to spell the words at the spelling test, these are disciplines of the mind. The multiplication table is a discipline. Practically all of the social graces are disciplines. And where these disciplines are not severe enough, the graces become disgraces. Every person must learn to control and direct his own thoughts and develop a consistent continuity of mental activity. He must be able to strengthen faculties which will serve him throughout his entire span of life. And today, we are subject to many interruptions, inconsistencies of thought, and a great many persons are deliberately trying to ignore experience. They want to avoid and evade the problem of facing themselves. As a result of this and other factors involved, confusion, stress, inconsistencies, the memory faculty is corrupted, it is damaged, and we lose the power to think from A to B and from B to C. So in childhood, we should be disciplined. And very often today, parents have not disciplined themselves. We inherit mental infirmities as a birthright. And the undisciplined mind, like an uncontrolled body, can be a cause of a great many problems. The disciplines we are seeking for are not only for the mind's sake, but give the mind the power to control and correct the mistakes of the emotions and the body. Without discipline, we cannot control ourselves. And we also have to have a background of experience to find out how to control ourselves and what we should allow and what we should not allow to come into our personal lives. In addition to the weakness of memory, we now find that there is a tendency to corrupt what memory we do have. Today we are able to imagine many, many conditions and then bestow upon these imaginations the strength of a memory factor. Many people today are remembering things that never happened to them. They are also remembering how things that did happen were so distorted or misunderstood as to lose the power to contribute to knowledge. Memory is here to help us to learn. Memory is part of universal schooling. But in many instances, we use it as a method or means of evasion, to get out of a situation. We use it to impress other people with our importance. We use it also to shift blame from ourselves to someone else. We use it for all kinds of evasions and compromises of attitudes. The only reason this is possible is because we have never disciplined it correctly. The mind is almost like another person in our body. This other person can be a perpetual adolescent and also a juvenile delinquent. And the worst part of the mental delinquent is it may be juvenile and be 70 years old. All the way along, we know that we are here to learn. We are here to grow. We're here to improve ourselves and to serve each other in useful capacities. And a bad memory frustrates nearly all of these purposes. The memory is essential to the preservation of any type of constructive program. Of course, it is also true that memory now is supported by the written word. And memory is supported by the press, by the media, and by all types of subsidiary helps. But most of these helps are themselves corrupted. We cannot depend upon what we read. We cannot depend upon news reports. We cannot accept the opinions of other people. And deprived of all of these crutches, we have to depend upon ourselves only to discover that we do not even have the power to make an opinion that means anything. So the problem always is that the mind has to serve as a kind of guardian, a protector of integrities. And to do this, it is necessary for us to have a full development of mental discipline. Now, this discipline must begin, as we have suggested, in childhood. It is up to our parents to see that we learn to obey. This is difficult because the parent hasn't obeyed in his generation and is becoming less and less interested in forcing unpleasant attitudes upon his children. The children, therefore, find that it is very easy to avoid or evade family discipline. And if it looks as though it might be a little difficult, the child may even leave home. Anything to escape the assuming of responsibility. And yet maturity without assuming responsibility is impossible. Today we have a mass of delinquent people who would be on the way to correct careers if they hadn't built a barrier against learning, a barrier against experimenting and experiencing the constructive results of growth. After all, if we are believing in a divine plan, we believe that the human being is here to grow, to unfold his spiritual potentials, to become a little better every day. And this process, according to many systems, continues incarnation after incarnation, always for the purpose of becoming better, always for the purpose of drawing upon internal resource with greater advantage to our own lives. Now, undisciplined internal resource is no longer an asset. Undisciplined, the mind can lead us into every trap that there is. It can force us to all types of mistakes. It can bring us down to misery because we accept flattery. It also makes it almost impossible for us to accept good advice. Now, good advice is something nearly everyone is afraid of today. Also, we have to wonder whether the person giving the advice is really qualified to do so. Therefore, in problems of accepting the advice of others, we must also depend to a certain degree upon our own internal resources. Someone may come to us and say we are drinking too much. One may, of course, to answer that is to say it's none of their business. But this does no good and just simply helps us to perpetuate a bad habit. Perhaps we do not believe that we are drinking too much. We do not know just exactly how to accept or reject the advice of a well-intentioned person. The only answer is to dig into our own experience. With a little sober thinking, it is possible for us to find out in ourselves what we are actually doing in the consumption of alcohol. We can find out by the use of memory what it has done to us in the past. If we find by reviewing our own case that we have suffered in the past, then the advice of a good friend should be given special consideration. And as one of the old Hindu sacred books points out, one of the ways that God speaks to mankind is by putting the words in the mouth of a good friend. So it's always wise to be observant. We also can realize that we may be blamed unjustly for things that we are not guilty of having performed. Here again only, our own memory can tell us what we did on all these different occasions, how we reacted to circumstances. Thus, it becomes possible to be a criterion over advice. We use this type of judgment on certain occasions. If we go to the doctor's office and the doctor recommends a remedy, we take it and it makes us worse. We have a certain recollection of this experience and are apt to remind the doctor of the situation. On the other hand, there are happenings every day in which things are going badly, and we ignore the evidence completely. Now, also, memory has a certain censorship factor. How much of the things we remember are worth remembering? How much do we really need this storehouse of software in our own skulls? How much do we actually depend upon memory to strengthen character or allow it to weaken character? Most minds today are cluttered. They are completely a mass of conflicting concepts and opinions, many of which are of no value whether they are true or not. It is necessary to try to find out how to clear the mind for the essential judgments of living. One of these problems, of course, one of the worst of these to face, is the problem of religion. Religion brings to the mind of the individual a variety of dogmas, teachings, creeds. The religious world is made up of systems of thought, backed by sages or saints or mystics, or unfortunately in our day, by a number of very shrewd businessmen. But actually, we may spend a lifetime studying a creed, only to find out before we come to the end of life that the creed was not correct in the first place. We were over-influenced by someone else's attitudes or opinions, or we were sold a deal because we did not think things through for ourselves. In this way, we can learn and memorize and quote vast amounts of information or misinformation that has little or no lasting value. We also find by studying the media and other methods of communication that we are loaded with opinions, prejudices, and conceits. We are exploited mentally and emotionally and physically all the time. We feel very sad about this sometimes, but it never seems to occur to most people to allow their own mind to be the leader and discipline the mind until it can lead properly. The individual reaching majority is supposed to be in a condition of the mind which will enable him to think straight and control and direct his own life correctly. He is supposed to be mature. By maturity, it does not mean that he is physically adult. By maturity, it means that he is in a condition of compound nature, which enables him to lead himself correctly through the future years of his life. If maturity does not bring with it judgment, the educational system has failed, the home has failed, the experiences of his friends have been ignored, and the individual is continuing to be a perpetual adolescent, and as such suffers continuously from his own mental weaknesses, but is not inclined to correct them. He finds other excuses, or evades them, or simply ignores the mistakes and their consequences. This builds up until it can produce practically every tragedy that we know in life. Nearly every disaster that happens to the individual has a major factor of lack of insight, lack of judgment, lack of common sense somewhere built into it. Now, as the individual goes along through the years, he accumulates a vast baggage of mental ideas, concepts, and baggage. He will constantly find that he is being influenced by his own thinking patterns. And these thinking patterns are very often not only inconsistent, but actually contradictory. We have a tendency in learning today to accept various points of view without question, even though they are irreconcilable. If you read three books on modern science, you may find statements in them that are hopelessly inconsistent. They will represent perhaps a very sincere and careful judgment by a person whose judgment was not sufficiently strong to prevent him from making mental error. Therefore, most books are really a story of ill-digested opinions. They are the individual reading somebody else's attitudes, and because these attitudes appear in print, they seem very important, very significant, and if well worded, can have a very captivating appeal. But when it's all said and done, there's no fact there. Now, to find facts for the average person, probably the Baconian point of view is as good as any. A fact is something that can stand the great tests that experience is subjected to. A fact must be reasonable. It must be a way that has been proven in the past. All facts, basically, are moral issues. And the moralities of those who live the best must be the guiding information. Also, there must be the factor that the belief or the attitude or the opinion is not contrary to the experienced good of mankind. Also, in this respect, we have great codes of laws to assist us in developing the integrities of life. These laws are built upon the experience of humanity over thousands of years. We often conceal these laws under the name of a single prophet or some great spiritual teacher, but they are actually an accumulation of man's experience. They are the evidences that have been gathered from lives and living over periods of centuries. Therefore, these things should be taken with some seriousness, and we should be very hesitant to violate a rule that has proved useful and correct for 5,000 years. And the fact that we are living now does not mean that we can break the integrities of the past. It should be that we would be stronger in keeping them. and perhaps adapt them a little more to our own current needs. But when the great teachings say, "Thou shalt not kill," that is exactly what they mean. And for thousands of years, we have broken this rule. We have justified it by every conceivable excuse. We have called it patriotism. We have called it inevitable. We have regarded it as a useful discipline. We have also thought of it as curbing the rapidity of population growth. But actually, the simple statement is the fact. And regardless of how we try to avoid and evade, the only thing that death that we can gain by destroying life is finally to destroy ourselves. So all the way along, we have this type of thing. Thou shalt not covet. These words have great meaning. In a world that millions of people accepting a religion with this statement in it and ignoring it completely. Why do they ignore it? Simply because their own internal integration has not recorded in the mind the validity of this statement. We have gone through all kinds of experiences of coveting, and our friends have, and our relatives have, and our world has. And we have seen the distress and misery. But when we decide to covet, we do. Now, this means that the discipline of the mind is not strong enough to protect us from the weaknesses of our own attitudes. So we discover that the mind has two distinct processes. One is to defend the right, and the other is to tear it down. Wherever a rule is uncomfortable, our first thought is to get rid of it. As a result of getting rid of it, we get into trouble, because practically every important rule of life has to be obeyed. And man was created, and not only to dream and to hope and to think, but also to obey the great laws of the universe in which he lives. Now, memory is extremely important in helping us to understand laws that we cannot penetrate metaphysically. We cannot find out how and why God says that we should love one another. We know this has descended to us as an axiom out of the past. We have internally and innately recognized it as highly desirable. We find it in the words of the teachers we revere. To the Christian, it is in the words of Christ. To the Buddhist, in the words of Buddha. And strangely as it may seem, love is one of the primary words of Muhammad. But with all this, why do we ignore it, compromise it, or misapply it? Because we cannot support the point of view with mental assurance. We have not the ability to quietly tune in upon the meaning of this word as we have experienced it ourselves. We are unable to divide the words from the deeds most closely associated with them. That's the reason why we have to say that the mind exercises censorship, that it gives us the background, the justification. It provides us with the torts and the research necessary to prove that integrity is right and that compromise is a desperate mistake. Now, if that's true, we go along and we finally clutter the mind up thoroughly with everything you can think of. We clutter it with our opinions and our thoughts and our habits. We clutter it with all our various avocational interests. We spend a whole lifetime trying to be good bankers or good lawyers and load the mind with these problems. We come home to sick children and load the mind with their problems. We also have troubles with our friends and take those on. And we watch the newspaper and try to take on the difficulties of humanity. By the time we reach middle life, we have a badly overworked mental structure. We are no longer in the position to control our own minds. We create all kinds of strange chemistries and interrelationships which we are not even constantly aware of. We do not know that we are thinking these thoughts. And if we do know they're coming through, we do not know where they come from or why. And so, by the time we reach 40 or 45 years of age, we are beginning to have poor judgment. A judgment in which we cannot get a clear answer when we ask ourselves a question. The answer comes through with all kinds of ifs, buts, and ands. Or perhaps we get so weary trying to find the answer we give up anyway. The mind can become a haunted house. It is full like an attic of antiques, things of some of which are very valuable and some are not very valuable. Not long ago, a family that I know did a little attic cleaning, and they finally found something that looked as though it might be worth a dollar or two, so they took it to a dealer, and the dealer gave them $10 for it. He then turned around and sold it to someone else for $500. The individual didn't know the value of what he had. Other people do not know the value of what they think. Others still don't realize that the skills that they accumulated over a lifetime have value. And because of the lack of discipline, they do not know how to call upon the resources of their own minds. Because of this type of thing, great many individuals who have had a rich life as far as experience is concerned are still subject to all the ills that flesh is heir to. They do not learn the lesson. Now, as we grow older, we find that this mind becomes tired. It is weary of the mistakes that it is making, but does not seem to get around to finding out why it makes these mistakes. It follows the general point of view that if I think this way, this is the way it is. And we feel that freedom and liberty and emancipation mean that our own thoughts are just as good as anyone else's, and if probabilities, a little better. And we also feel that while we may not want to accept the thoughts of others, there is every reason why they should accept our thoughts. All this leads usually to a rather lonely old age, because people just do not react the way we think they should. And the reason we think they should is because we don't think at all anyway. We just want them to and assume our own infallibility, although our minds have never been able to demonstrate it in any sense of the word. So by the time we go along, we begin to be what some have called disillusioned. We are tired of what we consider to be a life well lived, which nobody cares about or respects. Disillusionment means that we have gradually lost our illusions. An illusion, being itself unreal, if it is lost, if we are disillusioned, all we have lost is something that didn't exist in the first place. Disillusionment does not mean that we are tired or disappointed in truth. It means that we are tired or disappointed in the misinterpretations we have put upon various beliefs and opinions. But as we go along, we notice something happens. And that is that the mind, getting fatigued and also suffering from a kind of intellectual indigestion resulting from the way it has been nourished or misnourished, begins to drop out things. The mind isn't storing up things as rapidly as it used to, because every attic is full. It is not learning more because it has not been able to digest what it has learned. And gradually we notice a process coming over the mind's own functions. And that is that the memory continuities break down. And gradually we begin to forget. And this forgetting generally begins by forgetting unimportant things. The mind begins to censor itself as much as it can in its debilitated state. It says to itself, I know that somebody phoned yesterday but it wasn't important, so I can just forget that. And when someone says, did you get a phone call yesterday, we honestly say no, because we have forgotten. Or we put something in between the leaves of a book, something we think is treasures, and then we forget what book we left it in. Or we go out and buy something and do not know what happened to the change. We also are late in paying our bills and get penalties. Little by little, a mind which has never been trained begins to become a delinquent. It has the same responsibility reflexes as the adolescent who is not interested in doing anything that he's told to do. So these small things of life disappear. It's interesting to find out in working with people that where these small things fall out, they're generally things occurring in the middle years first. They fall out of the period, say, between about 20 and 50. In between 20 and 50, a great many details begin to fall out. We can remember that we made a trip, but we just can't remember where we went. And most of all, we can't remember the date. Well, we meet somebody we haven't seen for a long time. We know them, we've seen them, we remember things. We can't remember their names. The name has slipped. Now, at one time, that name could have been remembered instantly. But gradually, the power of all these details is lost because of the confusion that we have allowed to take over. We have never made a serious effort to remember. We've depended upon memory to serve us, but we have never nourished it, trained it, or done anything to make it useful. We just assume that the Lord intended us to have it, that it's something we didn't pay for in the first place, and which we can have for nothing for the rest of our lives. It is not that way in actual living. So little by little, a great many things fall out. This causes a measure of embarrassment. Here we have a Wednesday which we can remember, and a Friday that we can remember, but what happened on Thursday? We cannot remember. Now we assume, therefore, that it has something to do with Wednesday, and will in some way be manifested through Friday. That whole in between, we just do not know what happened. But we then begin to figure that if we tell people that, they'll think we're gradually losing our mind. And what they don't realize is that we've already lost them. So where facts begin to fail, imagination comes in. If on Friday we are better off than we were on Wednesday, we conclude that we made a magnificent decision of our own. If we're worse off on Friday, we decide that someone else has treated us badly. Anything that went well was due to our own merits. Anything that did not go well was due to somebody else's ulterior motives, or stupidity, or their forgetfulness. So gradually we build up a double world in which we live, a world of ourselves in which we usually write, a world in contact with other people in which they are usually wrong. This means that little by little, we begin to invent things. The teenager, we had one in to see me not long ago, a teenager who was having a great deal of trouble in school, talked about the miseries and disappointments and hardships of this living away from home, and how terrible the faculty treated him. Well, it would have brought tears to the eyes of a bronze monkey. But before it was over, in a moment of weakness, he pointed out how he had treated the faculty. That he had been a nuisance from the beginning, that he was never ready with his lessons, that he escaped everything that he could, that he cribbed whenever he could, and was also on probation for the use of marijuana. Now, these things, however, in no way excused the faculty for not liking him. He was likable to himself, and they should have agreed with him. But little by little, as we go through life, we find out that people who bring forward sad stories from the past very often fail to present both sides of the story. They know what other people did to them, but they do not know what they did to other people, and have tried in every possible way to forget it. Now, you can't always forget just because you want to, but you can push something to one side that is a fact, and particularly when reporting the occasion, you can carefully omit the part that is to your own disadvantage. This is a common experience in psychological and psychiatric counseling. It takes a lot of thought and time, and sometimes an almost impossible amount of patience, to actually get the truth out of the person in trouble. The truth is loaded with so much irrelevant material. It is surrounded by so many excuses that it sometimes takes a number of conferences to even make a dent in the defense mechanisms which the person has built for himself. It all ended up, he's at the psychiatrist or psychologist for treatment because his life has fallen apart. But even if he gradually admits that he had something to do with it, which he may under pressure, if you can keep at it long enough, he does not learn not to do it again. A little different situation arises. His experience does not directly cover it, and he goes into another cycle of trouble. All this begins by failure to culture the mind in the first place. The individual who in work is careful to avoid responsibility, who is lazy, who is interested more in doing as he wants to than as he should, to whom every job is simply a menace, these people gradually destroy their own mental lives and their own emotional backgrounds. And if they don't do it, some of their friends or relatives help them to get into these troubles. Now, one of the most common examples of this type of thing is alcoholism. Every alcoholic has had experiences that should have cured him. But his mind was not strong enough to give him the willpower to correct his own weakness. Now, the reason he has a mind is to discover the weakness and to support the correction of it. And where the individual keeps on making mistakes, he is ignoring the mind, and he is ignoring it because he has never given it authority or disciplined it or made it a useful part of his mechanisms. He has simply done as he pleased until the mind finally stopped chiding him and just gave up in despair. So this type of thing is something we all have to face as time goes on. Now, the effect of the mental forgetfulness on a religious level is very interesting. It will cause an individual to completely overlook a situation involving a conviction or belief about life. An individual joins a church or joins an organization, and he takes upon himself the obligations to keep the rules of that organization. We will say that perhaps in a small town he has gone out and received a riverside baptism. He has been born again. He has accepted the gospel. He has been given a New Testament to read, and he is reading it. He is trying his best. But I attended a meeting of evangelists and ministers some years ago, and they told me of the thousands of people they had converted at these riverside baptisms, small church baptisms, or whatever the facilities were at the time. And they admitted, under pressure, that 90% of the converts had to be reconverted at least once a year. It wouldn't hold. Now, assuming that a spiritual dedication to the service of God and truth is about as powerful a self dedication or a self enrollment in a faith that it's possible to imagine. In the presence of God, in prayer, surrounded by believers, who are doing everything they can to inspire this penitent to improve his life, and with his own promise, his most sacred promise, that he isn't going to make these mistakes anymore. In 6 or 8 months, he's right back where he was before. The alcoholic is drinking again. The immoral person is back in his habits. The shaky home is back shaky again because the old miseries and troubles come back. Why? Because actually the individual has not given discipline to his own life. If he had even done such a common everyday discipline as going to work every day to earn his living, he would have had a little strength. But, of course, if he did have to work, he objected to that, resented it, and could only dream of the time when no one could tell him what to do. So all this situation led to a failure as far as trying to get the individual's inner resources to work to help him. Now, as we grow older, as we say, some of these experiences begin to get a little weaker. And nature has one habit that is rather interesting. It weeds out those occurrences which most deeply impressed us. These it holds on to. The others gradually fade away. Now, the fact that we retain that which most impresses us does not mean that we will retain only that which is most useful to us. Almost anything can be among those points that are remembered. Some of them very bad, some of them are merely statements of delinquency and the consequences thereof, but they were positive, remembered factors in our experience life. Often these factors are not very fortunate. Very often they are tragedies, or sorrows, or misfortunes. But if we thought for a moment, we'd realize that nature has weeded out those things which could have been of great value if we had understood them. And also that they are still being brought back to us for consideration because maybe in a whole lifetime there were 20 occurrences that were remembered to the end. And these are the ones that had the big message. And really all of them involve suffering. The individual finds gradually that he is being reminded of the failures in himself. And these failures in himself come back to haunt him when other things are no longer remembered.